well. What we're going to cover here is those events in the 1760s which precede the war years themselves, the period from 1783 to 87 during the Articles of Confederation, and then in 87 the creation of the Constitution and its ratification. So in that respect, if you have chronology questions, in general the way I'll do a chronology question is I'll give three events in a group, and then another three events in a group, so you don't miss a whole lot at once. And you throw them in A, B, and C according to whichever came first. So you don't ever really have to memorize years, you just have to memorize cause and effect, what precedes which. However, I've always thought personally that if you slap a year on something, it just kind of, it's like, I've said this before, but it's like when you're driving, or even if you're not driving, you're just a passenger. You've always got to have the map with you and know where you are, how far the next stop is. So similarly speaking, years work that way. If you have a year stuck onto something, you can immediately recognize why it has significance with all the events around it. But if you're not a year person, just go on cause and effect, which even easier than that, if you can remember on what sheet where we were, which comes before which, then you'll get it in chronology. But most of the chronology questions are going to be pre-war, war, Articles of Confederation period, post-war, then Constitution and Bill of Rights after that. So this is where we start. Item one, John Adams of the Adams family, not the movie Adams family, but the political family. They trace their origins back to the Mayflower, literally, having been descendants of John Alden. And two presidents came from this family, as well as a number of ambassadors and historians, other scholars. So, of course, that would come later, so a biographic family by his future accomplishments. But anyway, this is, in other words, a mover and shaker of the revolution here. Writes a letter to a friend, Ezekiel Niles, in 1818. And Adams, by the way, I'll tell this story about Adams. A lot of this is just emotional warm-up. You don't have to write it all down. Adams and Jefferson both lived 50 years to the day after the signing, or the adoption, I should say, the adoption of the Declaration of Independence, which means that in 1826, they both died within hours of each other, thinking the other was still alive. And they had been close friends, they had been Revolutionary War allies, they had been political enemies, they had been at one point in time for a number of years on not speaking terms, and they finally came back together and started up a letter writing campaign and regained the friendship. So the perspective of these people by as late as 1818 is one looking back and being able to assess pretty clearly, still as participants, but after the fact what it means. So from this perspective of 1818, in his letter to Niles, Adams writes that many believed the revolution to start in 1776 and conclude at the end of the war. But what he argued was that by 76 the revolution was complete and finished. And what he meant, of course, in this letter was that the real revolt, the real turning around, as the revolution identifies is, was in the hearts and minds of people well before war was official, well before the Declaration was official. So he's talking about the period from 63 to 76 here. And what are the events that made that change? Now, in 63, if you ask a person that lived in North America their identity, they would be British. They might, or British North Americans, but they would not just be Americans in and of itself. Or they might be Virginians or New Yorkers, but it was either British or Virginians and New Yorkers. To become Americans in and of themselves is a real transformation of identity. And these are the events that bring this about. Two brings us back to where we left off on the last sheet, and that was the conflicting attitude difference between the British government and the Americans. As I said before in the quiz there, William Pitt rebuilt the administrative efforts of the British Empire and put into place permanent commitments to large spending and large spending on administrative forces. This ran a huge deficit, and it was considered the Americans' cause for the deficit, so it was their responsibility to repay it. And with that was more than just the immediate war. There was the feeling that the Americans were responsible for four wars, had been rescued out of four wars, and had paid for none of them. That's a misreading of history, but it's the attitude the British had. And so no longer would taxes be ignored, they would be enforced, and new ones would be added. Of course, the American attitude is quite opposite, and that is that none of the first three wars truly affected the Americans. They were started in Europe and spread over here just out of imperialistic desire, and that they could have been left alone throughout the first three wars without any consequences. And the last war ended up a victory with the defeat of the French in Canada, and so there's no threat. There was no obligation prior to the war, and there's no threat. So life can get back to as it should be. And this gives us some clue right here at the start that the American Revolution, while it brings about massive changes and throws off monarchy and creates new documents that we've not seen before, in many ways the American Revolution can be interpreted as being a conservative revolution. It's a maintenance revolution. It was a desire to not be shoved away from what they were comfortable with and to return to just being left alone. We'll see more of that to come. So now we're on three. As we said before, the Native Americans, all but the Iroquois nations, have been French allies throughout this century of warfare. And the way things, both the Iroquois with the British and all the other nations that fought with the side of the French, had evolved was that they were no longer indigenous nations. They didn't live off the land as they once did. They became pretty much welfare wards of the French or the British. So food, clothing, tools, blankets, etc., were paid to these Indian nations as long as they would remain mercenary fighters for the French or the British. Well, to put it into some kind of modern perspective, when the Soviet Union fell, what happened to places like North Vietnam and North Vietnam, same thing, and Cuba, Yemen, and places like that? Kind of S out of luck, in terms of, because like Cuba was selling all that sugar to Russia for artificial high price that wasn't real as a bailout program. And a lot, and it was true also for some nations that depended on the United States. Satellite nations that depended on the US and Soviet Union for foreign aid just disappeared because they no longer needed it. This is what happened to the Indians in North America. The French were not there anymore to provide that aid. There was no longer a need to pay off the Iroquois. Former French allies came to the new British conquerors and said, "We're used to working for the French, we'd be glad to hire out and work for you." To which the British said, "Against whom? We don't need you." And that created an economic crisis among the nations that existed in the Appalachian Ohio Valley area. To add insult to injury to the Indians, Americans were streaming across the Appalachians and the Ohio River in there to set up their settlement. In fact, let's go back and ask this. What caused the French and Indian War? Yes, the desire to set up a new colony. So now that they've won the war, the Americans have exactly that in mind, is to move in and start our colony. So they move across the Appalachians in Pennsylvania and New York into that area. So here are Indians who believe they're being encroached upon by illegal aliens, and they're also being cut off from what was a regular pretty lucrative foreign aid program. So in order to try to regenerate the foreign aid as well as stop the encroachment of the illegals, an uprising occurred led by a Shawnee uprising led by Chief Pontiac, which textbooks today describe as Pontiac's Rebellion or Pontiac's Uprising. Textbooks as late as the mid-60s were still calling it Pontiac's Conspiracy. Shows something about the subtlety of words used in history, of who's at fault, etc. The British commander of forces in North America, Jeffrey Amherst, after spending about half a year struggling and fighting against this, finally came to the conclusion that maybe the resumption of foreign aid or the resumption of gift giving was the answer, except what he gave was smallpox-infested blankets. And when the Indians received these gifts as an offering of peace, it caused an epidemic proportional spread of the disease throughout the nations and quelled the revolt. Yes?
Was he aware that those blankets were
Yes,
small?
It was on purpose, one of the earliest histories of biological warfare. Then Parliament declared that the crest of the Appalachian Mountains, which is this line, red line here, would serve as a boundary to no more further American encroachment of settlers, known as the Proclamation Line of 1763. And it really does have the 1763 in the name. I just put it in there for fun. On top of that, 2 years later in 1765, Parliament passes what's known as the Quartering Act, which authorizes the stationing of 10,000 troops on the frontier of North America as a way of keeping the peace. And of course, the way they keep the peace is to prevent settlement. So we're going to look at some other things that occur in 63 and 65 which create discontent, but if you're Americans, this time, British North Americans, and you won the war, and then the Indians rose up in resistance, and they're quelled, shouldn't you be able to move in and take the land? Shouldn't you be, in fact, escorted with these new troops in to take the land? Instead, the troops are there to prevent you from taking the land, and on top of that, colonists were expected to pony up the money to pay for the troops. That was part of the Quartering Act, that each of the legislatures were expected to come up with the money to build the barracks and the billeting for these troops. Other events of this time period, item 5. In 1761, a court case takes place involving the lawyer James Otis, a close friend of Samuel Adams. Otis is remembered for a phrase which we won't have on a quiz or test, but you falsely heard it as no taxation without representation. His actual phrase was taxation without representation is tyranny. That's not what this is going to be about here, but that's we've heard that phrase before. So let's examine that for a second. What does that phrase imply or mean? In the context of this time period, for Americans and British and taxes. It does give that impression. It gives that impression that the colonists ought to be able to elect a minister to Parliament, not just to their own local legislatures, but ministers. If they're going to tax us, then we should be able to have the right to send representatives and be in on the vote. That's the implication. But it's really not what they wanted. What they really wanted was no taxation and no representation. Just leave us alone. We'll send a few lobbyists over to periodically watch what you're doing and butter up the right politicians when we need it. But for the most part, we don't want representation and we don't want taxation. In this particular incident, what Otis was arguing for was a case to be made against the use of the writs of assistance. As I said, in the early 1760s, this is when custom agents began to use these search warrants as a way of trying to crack down on smugglers. It's all part of the Pitt program to get stricter about collecting the taxes and enforcing the law. And Otis's argument is that Americans are English persons, they're English subjects who have the same rights as those of England, and if those in England are never searched with these things because of the Magna Carta, because of the English Bill of Rights, just because of the basic rights that Parliament guarantees them, Americans should also be free of such unfair search and seizure. Which is a good case to be made. But the British attitude is, you are the ones that are guilty of all the violations, and so therefore there's reason, there's compelling interest here in such a law. Maybe not be fair, but it's compelling. He lost the case, but he made much attention over the unfairness of the use of writs of assistance. 2 years later, still in item 5, in 1763, is another incident, which all of this is seemingly unrelated, but we're going to tie it together in a minute, known as the Parsons Cause. This involved how ministers of the Anglican Church receive their regular salary. Rather than being paid in cash, they were paid a lump sum of tobacco, which they could sell on the open market for what they could get for it. In the late 1750s, the value of tobacco had been growing and growing, and so by about 1860-61, the state of Virginia, or the colony, I should say, the colony of Virginia, fixed a fixed salary and paid them in cash rather than tobacco. Well, by 63, these ministers were figuring if they were still getting the same lump of tobacco, they would have been selling it on the open market, they would have had higher salaries. So they sued for lost wages. And even though the jury opposed it, the judge had the authority to overrule the jury and grant in the favor of the Parsons. But Patrick Henry's, the one who's known for the phrase, give me liberty or give me death, he made such an eloquent attack against the Parsons, calling them greedy, demanding the separation of church and state, that when the jury was told to give its award, they awarded one pence or one penny back pay to the ministers. And there was a cartoon in the paper this weekend I saw that made you think of this incident where, I don't know if you saw this or not, a moderately confused cartoon, and it shows somebody interviewing for a job, and the guy at the, I guess the personnel officer at the computer is saying back to him, how does 3 gallons of gas an hour sound? It's kind of reminded of the Parsons in the back of it. So when we put this together here, Otis's fight against the writs of assistance, the Parsons' cause over the issuance of paying minister salaries out of the tax bill, the Quartering Act, placing in troops in North America and demanding that Americans pay for them whether they wanted to have a whether they had a voice or not in Parliament. What is all this? Does this have anything in common? Could these things happen today? That's a good answer. Theoretically, no. A few extra Patriot Acts they could, but right now, theoretically, this shouldn't be able to happen, because in each of these cases, what would prevent this? Yes.
It depends if martial law is
before. That's what I'm saying. A few more incidents. Under normal circumstances, we've lived through some surprising times, but under normal circumstances, the Parsons wouldn't be suing for back wages because they wouldn't be suing the state of Virginia, at least. Why not? Because that's an established church. That's a state, and we don't have a state established church. First Amendment says Congress will make no law establishing religion. So that's a change that came about. What about the use of the writs of assistance? By the Fourth Amendment, we would demand that a court-ordered warrant be the only legal document rather than just a little writs of assistance search device. So the Fourth Amendment would protect us from that. What about the quartering of troops in our homes against our will? Would that be doable?
No.
Not in peacetime. In wartime, yes, but in peacetime, it wouldn't be according to which amendment. Third amendment, yes. And what I didn't say in this incident, but a little later in the story, we do know that one of the things that triggers conflict, one of the things that causes the British to go out to Lexington and Concord, was they were going to confiscate what? Hidden weapons, yes. And so the right to bear arms, free from government interference. So what I'm getting at is that if you look at the Bill of Rights, and if you look at the Constitution, they are constructed in direct proportion to experiences that went on with the British right at the beginning of the Revolutionary War. Those are the causes. Sometimes we look at the Bill of Rights and the Constitution, kind of ask ourselves abstractly, you know, why is that in there? Why would they limit power here? Or why would they be so concerned about this issue? It is a direct British abuse. You can find it in the Declaration of Independence also. Things that Jefferson lists are abuses of Parliament are very much related to what's in the Constitution and Declaration of Independence. Okay. Oh, that's six there. Now we're on to number seven. By 1763, two different British ministries had changed. There had been a Pitt as well as Rockingham ministry that had come and gone. But in 1763, the most assertive and powerful officer of Parliament was First Lord of the Treasury, George Grenville. And as Lord of the Treasury, his major focus was how to get this debt replenished. The laws in Item 8 are his approach taken. The enactment of the 1764 Sugar Act, and Currency Act, and the 1765 Quartering Acts and Stamp Act, which we've already talked about, Quartering Act. The Sugar Act, it is a restructuring of the old Molasses Act. We talked about the 1733 Molasses Act, where you were supposed to pay 6 pence per barrel for sugar, recognizing that that rarely got paid, and state customs agents just got bribed out of it. They lowered the price of the tax down to 3 pence per barrel and made a strong plea to people to be honest and follow the law and pay the tax. Instead, it just lowered the bribe. The Currency Act of 1764. This is a law that said colonies could no longer, through their legislatures, print and issue paper money. This is the way that colonists dealt with deflationary periods. Most post-war periods tend to be deflationary because you have the competition of government with private spending in the marketplace, and when a war ends, the government spending for products and salaries, et cetera, come to a cease, and so there is a drop-off of demand. And with the drop-off of demand, it usually means that there has to be a slowdown of supply, and though therefore suppliers are definitely not giving wage increases. If anything, they're firing people and giving wage decreases. And so most of the time in a post-war period, when it's deflationary, you have a shrinking amount of money in circulation. The way the colonists had dealt with the post-French and Indian War period was to try to issue paper money which would inflate the economy. Now, it wouldn't be dependable money because you never know how much it was worth, and so as you went from one colony to the next in your business dealings, you had to find out how many Pennsylvania dollars would actually equal New York dollars, and how much will you be willing to take today on the exchange rate. But that was the way they sufficed for the lack of currency, was print and paper money. If Parliament had its way and could force the pound sterling coinage to be the only money, while it would be a hardship for the colonists, it would make money more valuable for the merchants in England. So that's what the Currency Act did. It forbade issuing paper money. And on this money business also, absence of currency, one of the reasons that the United States adopted, after they were an independent country, the dollar, was because the dollar was originally a Spanish coin, not the British coin. And there was actually more Spanish coinage, pieces of eight, in fact, I think is what made up a Spanish dollar. 2 bits, 4 bits, 6 bits, 8 bits a dollar made up the Spanish coin. And there were more coins available from trade in the Caribbean with Spanish islands than there was British pound sterling. So this was an effort to try to strengthen the pound sterling at the expense of the colonists. It's very mercantilistic. Put the hardship on the colonists in order to improve the trade for the British. The Quartering Act, we already mentioned, it stationed troops in North America to protect and defend against, protect the Indians really from American migration. And it carried with it the expectations that colonists through their legislatures would pay for these troops. But the most known, most hated, and actually least enforced, never really was enforced, law of this time was the Stamp Act. And it's the one that gets most of the headline attention. All of these are Grenville programs trying to replenish the debt. The Stamp Act worked this way. A number of commercial products, dice, playing cards, newspapers, commercial flyers, contracts, wills, those working in those businesses would be expected to buy a tax stamp, tax seal, place it upon each of the items, and if they were like selling newspapers, it's one per newspaper. So it'd be like a business tax, which means that the business persons would have to make up the loss of the tax by raising the price of the product. Now, stamp acts were not new at all. This was a common form of tax in English history. What made this particular one so detested was it was passed in Parliament to apply only to the American colonies. It did not apply to all of England, but it did apply to all 13 colonies. And while this would hit harder on commercial communities, it was the fuel for the newspapers like Zinger and others to start complaining and criticizing that everybody's in the same boat together on this abuse. there was such a quick revulsion against even the concept of a Stamp Act applying only to the American colonies, that a group of, what do we call them, freedom fighters or terrorists, known as the Sons of Liberty, freedom fighters because they're ours now, came forward and tarred and feathered tax collectors, burnt some figures in effigy, threatened homes, burned some homes, so much so in the Boston area, in the New York area, that when the tax stamps arrived, that tax agents never even would apply them. In addition to the terroristic violence expressed towards tax collectors, American merchants came together and made an agreement they would not do business with British merchants until the Stamp Act was repealed. A little more about the Stamp Act in a moment, but first, item 9. Another feature of Grenville's changes involved reforming the Customs Service. It's again a shake-up and replacement, fire people, hire new people. And with the addition of the use of vice admiralty courts or naval courts for smugglers. So no longer would American smugglers be tried in civilian courts, but rather naval courts, which, as you can see in item 9 here, did not have juries. So this will give us another peek into the future of why Amendment 6 guarantees the right to jury trial. And a phrase up in 8 I want to get to before I get away from it is, again, this concept of the American Revolution being a conservative revolution. When we think of revolutions, French is an example, Russian's an example, it's common for a group of people who did not have property and did not have power to eventually rise up, overthrow those enfranchised. Society is turned upside down, power is turned upside down, and the people that were with nothing in the beginning end up with the commanding voice in the end. This is not the American Revolution. The American Revolution is launched not by the poorest at the bottom of society. It is launched by the wealthy merchants who do not like these taxes. They persuade people of all economic classes and backgrounds to join in, but it is not triggered by the poor. It is triggered by the wealthy elite, who are angry at British wealthy elite and about these policies. So in that respect, it is not a radical revolution. It's quite a conservative revolution. And in other regards, what everybody's wishes were was to return to the pre-1763 period, the period when British tax laws either did not exist or were not enforced. So that may explain, even though we were a colonial nation, we fought a war and killed our colonial masters, gained independence, Americans by and large are not comfortable with radicalism. They're not comfortable with revolutions. And it's because most of the world's radical revolutions have been of that class nature rather than the one that occurs. Back to arguments against the Stamp Act in item 10 here. It comes back to this idea that when Parliament made a law or made a tax which applied only to the 13 colonies rather than to all of England, their argument is it violated its authority. That always in the past, taxes that applied only locally were initiated locally by the local legislatures. And if Parliament passed a navigation law, it applied to everywhere, India, to Ireland, to Caribbean, then they may not like the law, but they would at least recognize its legal authority. So their argument here is that the major problem with the Stamp Act is it's an illegal law. It's an internal tax, which should only be left to local legislatures. And that's where this taxation without representation argument starts to come back. That in our local legislatures, we do elect our own representatives, so it's just and fair. But in Parliament, we do not. The parliamentary response was, but you are represented. That's not fair to say you are not represented. Everybody in Parliament is represented through the notion or concept of virtual representation. Just because you don't directly elect a minister doesn't mean you're not cared for. There are many boroughs in England that do not elect ministers. And there are those that have no constituents that do elect ministers. There's not, in the English, there wasn't then, there really isn't now either for that matter, a direct correlation between who votes for whom representing what area. And the rationale behind that was, if people were completely responsible to only their local voters, but they're making national policy, but the only people they have to report back to is just Arkansas, or just the 4th District of Arkansas, wouldn't they spend all their time just passing every pork barrel project and building airports that we don't need, et cetera, running up a huge national debt? So the parliamentary idea was that when people are concerned with the well-being of the empire as a whole, you don't run into all that wasteful, unnecessary spending. So you colonists are going to all be all taken care of. That was the virtual representation of it, of course, which they know they were not well cared for. There is something missing here. Oh, it is, number 10 here. Two different gatherings came forth making this argument we just made about the internal-external tax, the representation argument. One was a Congress held in New York in 1765 called the Stamp Act Congress, which five colonies sent representatives. And the colony of Virginia, its legislature issued something called the Virginia Resolves, in which it also made the argument against the legality of this taxation. Now, one of the holes in their argument that has to be recognized here is that if they can dictate what taxes Parliament can make and what taxes they can't, and if they can declare what their legislatures are able to do, that implies the idea that their legislatures have some constitutional authority. And that had never been agreed upon. These legislatures only arose because of the necessity out of this ad hoc emergency conditions. The Parliament had never recognized the legality of these legislatures. Now, it kind of did in one way when it let these local legislatures pay the salaries of the governors. That's a tacit recognition. When they expected the local legislatures to come up with the money to pay for the troops through the quartering acts, that's a recognition. But in strictest legal sense, American legislatures have never been declared legal. Well, in 1766, in item 12, Parliament passes two measures within a day of each other. They repeal the Stamp Act, and they also pass the Declaratory Act. The repeal of the Stamp Act was really a result of the merchant boycotts. Since American merchants comprised about a third of all the British business, it was just too much just to let go on. And so in this game of chicken, the American merchants won out and got the Act repealed. But the Declaratory Act that followed the Stamp Act had an interesting wording to it. It said, you don't have to write it all down, you just listen to it, but Parliament has the right to bind the colonies and make all laws whatsoever concerning the colonies. So bind the colonies and make all laws whatsoever concerning the colonies. What that Declaratory Act means and says is that it has full authority. The American legislatures don't have any real legal positioning in the empire. But at the same time that they're denying the authority of the American legislatures, they're also caving in and repealing the Stamp Act. So there's kind of a mixed signal here. The American colonists recognize that they've lost a legal battle, but they've won a real economic battle, the repeal of the Stamp Act. And what happens in the build-up to the American Revolution is it starts in fits where a series of laws happen, Americans resist, the laws are repealed, things could have been normal again, and then more laws are passed. There is this kind of mistaken notion about the American Revolution that once things got on the path of 1763 and moving, it was inevitable that it's going to lead to a 76, a revolution. But there's quite a few times along the way where the British could have just backed away from what they were doing and there would have been no revolt, no independence movement. Well, this isn't one of them. In item 13, the British decide to again try taxes on the Americans. A new leader of Parliament built his coalition is Charles Townshend, Chancellor of the Exchequer. He replaced Grenville now as the prominent minister. It is his responsibility to do what Grenville was doing, and that is trying to replenish the deficit that came from the French and Indian War. The deficit has actually grown worse because a group of wealthy farm landowners would squeeze peasants off their lands for the Enclosure Acts in a mercantile manner, wanted the taxes on their lands reduced. So Townsend has caved into and agreed to a massive tax cut for the wealthy. Shocking that that would happen. But he's got to find some way to make up for the shortfall. So he figures, go to the ones that don't vote, the Americans. And that's what comes, the Townsend Acts, Townsend Laws and Taxes, listed here in 13 through 15. Lead, tea, paper, paint, and glass will now be placed on a tax list. Things the Americans bought in high demand. One more effort is made at shuffling the bureaucrats by creating the Board of the Commissioner of Customs. And they will be encouraged strongly to use writs of assistance to search for smugglers. One of the key real big changes here at the Townsend Acts is governors' salaries will no longer be paid for by colonial legislatures. They'll be paid for by Parliament, and their continued employment and their salary increase will be based on their record of performance for enforcing the laws using the writs of assistance. And in item 15, Parliament issues an order that the New York legislature is shut down until it's willing to make its first order of business appropriate money to pay for these troops out on the frontier. Parliament's tired of paying for the Quartering Act. The greatest bulk of these troops are on the New York frontier, so New York's legislature is shut down until they will vote money for the troops. So these are impactful. New taxes, new customs agents, governors who actually do their job now, closing down of a legislature. This is steps of tyranny taking place. And the people in item 16 make sure that everybody finds out about it. Samuel Adams and James Otis. Otis, our lawyer, involved in the writs of assistance case before. He is the influential money person who gets with the firebrand Rush Limbaugh kind of guy. And that's net in both a good and bad way. Samuel Adams. Samuel Adams is a really critical, important figure for this revolution. The image that we usually get of Samuel Adams is what? A beer, yeah, a brewer, which is so misleading because he wasn't a brewer. In fact, nobody was a brewer. So we'd be real lost. I mean, in terms of commercial brewing, there was no serious commercial brewery in America until 1828. Beer was brewed personally in people's homes or in taverns. Recipes were so varied you never got the same thing twice in a month. And so he had nothing to do with brewing. But in fact, even the photo that's on the bottle is not really a Samuel Adams photo. It's a John Singleton Copley photo of Paul Revere changed to look like Samuel Adams. But what Samuel Adams is known for is the following. He's a cousin of John Adams. He recognized the family name and expectations. He went to Harvard like Adams and graduated. But after that, he was pretty well downhill. He worked for a while as a tax collector and was fired for embezzlement. Lived off the goodwill of family and friends, rarely holding a job, but he did find a calling in life. He could go into a tavern, and maybe that's where the association with beer comes from. He'd go into a tavern, a public hall, buy a round, a tankard of ale for everybody, and by the second tankard, he had everybody hating and wanting to feel British. He could come up with, sometimes they were true stories, sometimes they weren't, but they always worked. They always had people wound up and inspired. So Adams felt his calling and just being anti-British, and he was always on the forefront of the American Revolution. And when the Townsend Acts came out, he got together with Otis, and they put together kind of like an underground newspaper letter system called Circular Letter. sent it to everybody they knew in every colony, tried to get as much of it published in newspapers, in which they brought attention to people about these British abuses. Well, by the eyes and the size, it looks like you had all you can take, so we'll pick up with item 17 when we return. And although we have a bunch of cool stuff for a quiz, no quiz next time.